there are birds chirping around me, and that's something I cannot control. So let's just get straight to it. Welcome to the Brenda's Foundation podcast. This year, I'm back with more episodes in the series, The Legacy, Africa Through Their Eyes. This is a series that features past heads of state of African countries as they walk us through their personal journeys and lessons on leadership, managing the top office of government, and how they define their legacy. This is one you do not want to miss. And so if you've missed the other episodes, you can check the links in the description and catch up on them. So joining me today is His Excellency Seretse Khama Ian Khama, former President of the Republic of Botswana. President Khama is a politician and former military officer who was the fourth president of the Republic of Botswana from April 1st, 2008 to April 2018. President Khama descends from a long line of Botswana royalty. He's a son of Botswana's first president, Sir Seretse Khama, and also the great-grandson of Khama III, or Khama the Good, who made Botswana a British protectorate. Anyway, after serving as commander of the Botswana Defence Force, he entered into politics and was vice president of Botswana from 1998 to 2008, and then succeeded Festus Mogae as president on April 1st, 2008. He won a full term in the 2009 election and was re-elected in October 2014. In 2018, he stepped down and has since remained an active statesman and engaged citizen in and beyond the continent. So, to stop pinching myself right now, let's get straight to the episode with His Excellency Lieutenant General Dr. Seretse Khama Ian Khama. Your Excellency Seretse Khama Ian Khama, it's good to have you here today. Thank you for joining me on the Brentas Foundation podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, thank you.
Awesome.
Yes.
All right. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your time as president and your legacy since then. So to get us started, I thought it would be interesting to know a bit about April 1st, 2008. Can you tell us a little bit about what that feeling was when you were officially president of Botswana?
Well, of course, as you would imagine, stepping into the shoes, the very big shoes left for me by my predecessors, and knowing that you are taking on that huge responsibility as a head of state, it obviously I wouldn't be human if it didn't have some, you know, something I hadn't thought about. But it wasn't as much of a culture shock as you would expect, because I had been vice president before, for several years, before I took up that, and I was working closely with my predecessor. And it's something that, because in Botswana, we are stuck in this situation of automatic succession, because the late President Masire, he left office sort of like in between elections. So in our constitution, you do 10 years or two terms. Two terms meaning from one election to the next. So because he left midterm, halfway between, then in the constitution it says if that was to happen, the vice president automatically it takes over. So it wasn't like, again, I had just come out of an election and was stepping into the presidency. So I succeeded him, President Mogae, and of course, in the lead up to that, you're aware of it and you prepare for it. So like I said, it didn't sort of come as a new turf for me. So one had been kind of groomed for that. But like I said, on the day itself, you knew that you were inheriting all that responsibility.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. And looking back sort of on that day, who would you say that man was, and how did your tenure change you, if it did?
You know, I once said to somebody who I won't mention, I said to them, I believe that when you assume that office in any country, it does change a person, for the better, for the worse. And I said to this person, I said, please let me know if you detect or see any changes in me, because that's the last thing I would want to happen, especially if it's a change for the worse. Mm. Well, fortunately, that person never indicated to me that I was changing. And what I did, which gave me the confidence to do the work I was doing, was to say that as we're in a democracy, and a democracy is supposed to be about people, I should go out and meet people as often as I can. And I was doing it approximately every 2 weeks, going and having public meetings for people to be able to tell me what their expectations were of their government. And then I would come back and we would, it helped to fashion our policies and programs going forward. But of course, even when I was vice president and I had done that, I came into office already with a list of things that I wanted to do, that I wanted to implement in terms of programs and policies. Unfortunately, was 2008, you remember, was also the year that the world economic downturn took place. So a lot of the things that I had planned, I had to shelve and quickly rethink. But in rethinking, I was driven by making sure that people who are not well off, the poorer people in our society, the disadvantaged, their situation shouldn't decline. And therefore, I put in programs and policies to shore them up. So that was how we went about it. And then coming back to that first day, for me, the biggest shock was not the day I became president, but the day I entered politics is a day I won't forget to this time.
Because tell us about that.
It was a very miserable day for me.
What was it?
Because I had been in the army. And I intended finishing my career in the army and going on and doing charitable work, going into tourism and that type of thing. Conservation, and when my predecessor asked me to come in, and the reasons he gave me, and knowing that it was something that my father had wanted to do, but for myself, politics had never been my ambition. So when I left the army and went into politics, that first day I can remember very clearly, I was extremely miserable. And in fact, that misery continued for the rest of the week. That was a culture shock for me, going from the army into politics.
What exactly
totally
about
different.
It?
Pardon?
What exactly about it made it miserable?
You know, the thing is that in the army, it's like one for all and all for one. There is the regimentation, the discipline, things are orderly, they work. Well, but politics is dirty, it's a free-for-all. You know, yes, the only thing it had in common is that we were all wore the same color. The uniform was, you know, we were still wearing uniform at the time. But otherwise, the attitude of people in the political arena was just a totally different situation compared to what I was used to in the military, yeah.
So I'm curious, since being president and even observing, you know, sort of other presidency in Botswana and also across the continent, what would you say are some of the insights on leadership and decision making that you've gained that you wish you knew when you first became president?
I don't want to sound big-headed or arrogant when it comes to leadership and decision making. Mm. Because like I've just said, having been in the army, my whole career was in the army.
Right.
It was all about leadership and decision making. Mm-hmm. So that aspect of it was very easy, you know, from my point of view.
Exactly.
The only difference is that you had to do a lot more consultation. You couldn't just wake up like in the army and just say, right, it's my way or the highway,
yeah.
You know. And like I used to often remind soldiers that, you know, when you're in the army, we are there to defend democracy, not to practice it. So that was in the, it was in the military. So yes, that was the thing. The decisions you could still be making, you could still be formulating your plans, but then sitting down, you still did it in the army. Mm. But then, to a certain extent, you know, it didn't have to go through processes. It didn't have to go through cabinets and parliament and various other institutions and organs before you finally came around to implementing something. That was also something which is a bit of a frustration, because it tended to delay delivery and implementation, because in a democracy, that is what is expected. You can't just wake up in some dictatorships and say, it's going to be like this. Mm-hmm. But the general principle of leadership and decision making was still there. Yeah.
Mr. President, if I can ask, what is one of your fondest memories of being president of Botswana?
That's a difficult one. Because from my own private and personal life, it was turned upside down. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, it wasn't enjoyable, you know, because of the expectations people had on you, the demands that were put on you. And you had to, you know, devote, well, what I did anyway, all your time to the job. But what made me happy was, when I talked about earlier about the programs and policies that I put in place, was how those were appreciated, how you were able to help people, especially the disadvantaged in our society. So that generally was what made me happy, the way we were able to achieve economic growth, to continue to expand and improve upon our democracy. What stands out as an event, a single event, was the 50th anniversary of our independence, which was in 2016. And for me, it was very particularly symbolic, because I knew when I stood there presiding over that occasion, I thought back to 50 years earlier, when it was my father who was actually presiding over the independence of the country. So 50 years later, to be able to celebrate what he had and others had ushered in 1966, was something that you know, I won't forget.
That is remarkable.
Yeah.
Knowing what you know now, and even reflecting on your experience being in the military and all that, are there different ways you would go about running government and basically being head of state in Botswana?
To be honest, and again, not to sound big-headed, I think that as a result of consultation and occasionally even tapping into the experience of others, you know, who were in other arenas outside of our country, what we put in place in order to improve, because I had introduced what my guiding principles would be, the 5 Ds. Which was democracy, development, dignity, discipline, and delivery. So those things were what I used as a guide.
Yeah.
And I think those are some things which I try to remain true to in guiding me throughout the period I was head of state. Mm-hmm. So I would say that no, I don't think there's anything too different that I would have done, yes.
And in terms of, you know, the qualities of leadership, and I think, you know, your experience in the military definitely would be helpful, and also being president, if we were to talk about some of the key qualities of a leader to be able to run a country, what are some of the things that you would say are important and that, you know, people and the populace should look out for in sort of vetting people who are seeking highest office?
I think the most important thing for a leader is to be modest. Because on our continent and in other places, you will find that leadership, they tend to think, is all about themselves and not about the people.
Yeah.
So if you always go to bed saying people first and wake up in the morning saying people first, which is what I used to do, that'll keep you on track. And that it's not about you at all. And when you look at governance and when we try and incorporate good governance. Those are the facets that should be embedded in every single thing we do on a day-to-day basis. And there'll always be attempts or temptations, you know, to pull you in this direction or pull you in that direction, even amongst people around you, wanting to feather their nests and use their positions to do so. And you just have to keep on reminding yourself that, no, that is not how it should be. And when you look at our continent and see how leaders have succumbed and allowed a situation whereby they think they are God's gift to their countries and that no one else can rule, and they extend their terms in office by hook or by crook, that is when things go wrong. And you look at countries like that, and you look at the state of their economies and the state of their democracy and human rights, you see it is all in, it's in tatters. And some of those who profess to have a democracy, those democracies, the aspect of democracy disappears when their incumbency is threatened.
Of course, yeah.
So when they say, okay, let's have elections, and you'll see how elections are rigged left, right, and center in several parts of the continent. But it's not only the continent. My favorite example is Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, you just look at how he totally took the presidency to be some kind of personal fiefdom, a kingdom, you know, that he would like to see himself up there on a pedestal. And that's when it just became a totally chaotic situation around his presidency and around him. Everything he says, everything he does is just chaos. And it's really shocking and surprising and highly disappointing that he has people who support him, you know. But obviously in the same mentality, the same frame of mind as he is. But this continent of ours, you know, we've still got a long way to go. We've come from far, but unfortunately it seems we've still got a long way to go on the issues of good governance and democracy and adherence to human rights.
Mr. President, a lot of the listeners for the podcast are, you know, sort of young, early middle career people who are looking to be in the space of governance, politics, and things like that. Given your experience, given your observation, what is a piece of advice or pieces of advice that you might give people who are looking to be political actors and looking to create a different, you know, different country, different continent? The kind that serves people and slightly different from what we've seen over the past, you know, 60-something years on the continent.
Well, you basically said it all, I mean, yourself, about what they should do. Because, unfortunately, a lot of people, and in the time that I was in politics, who wanted to be, whether it's councillors or members of parliament or presidents or whoever, a lot of people, not all, but a lot of them, it was driven by self-interest.
Right.
Because after winning an election, whether as a councillor or as a member of parliament, they then disappear. And you see them again at the next election, going to their people and saying, vote for me again. They say, but where were you all along when you were supposed to be engaging with your people almost literally on a daily basis to hear from them what their problems are, and doing your best to try to ensure that if it was in the council or in parliament or in government, you try to improve their welfare and their way of life. And you just realize that whenever it comes to election time, whenever there's a competition, it's driven a lot by self-interest. So I would really say to people, if they think politics is a way to get rich, and to feather your own nest, please don't go down that road. Don't look at it, because you're not going to then be able to make any significant contribution, credible contribution, to your country and its people. So it should be a genuine desire, like people who are in humanitarian organizations, who give up their time, their lives and everything to go and work for others and try to do their best to improve the lives of their fellow citizens or other human beings in other parts of the world. It should be that kind of calling that should get them into it, and not to try to say, no, they pay lip service to wanting to do that, but then once they get into the position, they do the opposite. Yeah.
What would you say about how to manage yourself in trying to get into some of these spaces where the status quo isn't exactly, you know, accepting of people like that? Because you're coming to disrupt what things, you know, the way things are and how people do things. How do you manage being in spaces like that and still maintain your integrity and still stay grounded without, you know, falling into that? Because I say that because it's quite frustrating to see sometimes. There are lots of people that you hear them say the good things, they can write even in books and stuff like that, but you know, they get in there and it's like a two years later, you can't believe it's the same person you listened to, you know, for years on radio or read about. And it's, what happens there, and how do we try to safeguard the ambition to be different and to continue to want to do different?
You know, the one thing that keeps you on the straight and narrow is offering yourself up for accountability that comes from the people. So if you go out, like I said earlier, that you go out regularly to people and you want to listen, because I used to say to them that I, in those early years, considered myself a student and them as teachers, because I was coming to them to learn, to hear what it was that they wanted. And that process never ends, because during the life cycle of anybody in office, this is a changing world. All the time things are changing. So don't think that a manifesto you had on day one will still be relevant even a year later, even though it may be a manifesto for 5 years. Things constantly change, like when I made reference to the economic downturn. You know, you could have your best plans put in place and then they will get, you know, overturned and disrupted. So it means you have to keep on touching base with people to find out what is affecting their lives and how you can respond. And if you put yourself there in front of them, giving them the opportunity to speak freely to you and say what they like to you, that'll keep you on track. And it'll keep you accountable and transparent. And if you stop doing that or you don't do it, you will never be held to account. I mean, yes, you can have your parliament where MPs can be standing up and holding you, trying to hold you to account and everything. But you just know that, right, those MPs are part of the political game.
Right, yeah.
And how sincere are they actually when they stand up and talk on behalf of other people? Go to the people themselves on the ground and hear it from them. And you also learn tolerance at that time. And you, as I say, when you subject yourself to that, that is what keeps you beholden to what it is you're supposed to do in providing for the citizens of your country. Yeah.
What would you say is one thing that being in government taught you about life that you think everyone should learn or know at some point?
You know, when I used to go around, like I've said, sometimes it would be public meetings, sometimes it would be walkabouts, where I just go into a settlement or a town or something and just walk the streets, meeting people and still hearing from them what it is they did. You know, I always, it always bothered me how, you know, some people are really struggling with life. And one would sometimes be frustrated that maybe our budget, because we are still a developing country, would not be able to respond to their needs. That's why on the side, I also ran charities where I would go to the private sector for donations. And for example, I was involved in a charity that I started in providing houses for destitute people or poor people or pensioners, people who didn't have decent living accommodation. And I continued or tried to continue doing that after I left office, before the current tried to frustrate all my efforts in doing that. But I still, you know, continued it, but at a smaller scale. So it was to try to get the citizenry to respond, those who could afford to, that it's not just government's responsibility to help fellow citizens, it's everybody's responsibility. And a lot of people came to the table with that. But like I said, for me, was it always bothered me how some people had to live their lives, and therefore programs we had to put up should respond to that.
That's amazing. When you look, you know, back on this time and even now, reflecting on your legacy as president, what would you say you are most proud of, and how do you hope that this legacy, for instance, continues to shape Botswana now and in the future?
I think I was happy when I left office by the programs and policies I'd done for the disadvantaged in our society. Other aspects, like when it came to the tourism, how we really propelled Botswana to be one of the best tourist destinations on the continent, even in the world, when you look at some of the awards that we were given, international awards we were given for our tourism, and how we were able to grow it and get it to appeal to many people all over. Like I said, we talked about the disadvantage. Also, I think what I did for agriculture, because in the first year we managed to triple our cereal production through programs we put in place, because up until then our agricultural sector was sort of like just stumbling along. And even though I knew that the country was prone to droughts, but we just said, no, but there are other countries we know of which have been able to do a lot. And the important thing at that time, when the recession was making food more expensive for people to get hold of, said, no, but let's grow our own food. Let's feed ourselves. And so we put in a new program which did achieve that. And you saw people all over, you know, during the height of the season when we were reaping the benefits from what we had planted. You saw with the horticulture sector, the crop sector, things were going very well. So I think from that aspect, it was well taken up. Also, I think we improved significantly the health sector in the country, the education sector. We used to send a lot of our students outside the country, but we allowed private institutions to start and to build up in the country, and government would then sponsor our own citizens in our own institutions instead of having to send them out and spending our money on foreign institutions when we could have done it into. So we did a lot of that. That also made an impact on the education sector. We did a lot for youth, you know, and women empowerment, and also our traditions and culture, because I would like to believe, and something I'm proud of, was that we did revive our culture and traditions during the time by putting in place events throughout the country on an ongoing basis that all ages did participate in, as well as the sports that we started doing very well internationally. So those are some of the things, including, I think, I was always determined that we should remain, during my presidency, the least corrupt country in Africa, and improve our corruption rankings, you know, worldwide, which we did achieve. Of course, that has all gone now. So those are the things that one look back on what we had achieved. Yeah.
That is a great legacy. So as we round this conversation up, looking ahead, what would you say is your vision for the future of Botswana? Are there particular areas that you think require a bit more critical attention to make the Botswana that you imagine it can be in the next 20, 30 years?
Well, you know, you talked earlier on about how maybe my legacy may contribute towards what you have just said now. Unfortunately, as you know, my story, and I won't go into it because I think everyone is aware of it, we have a reversal of what was achieved for over 50 years. So from 2018, we've just been in a downward slide in terms of democracy, governance, the rule of law, human rights, our economy, everything. What we had achieved for conservation, the environmental protection is all now in tatters. And so it's very difficult for me to answer that question. We could only get back to where we were. I'm not just talking about when I was in office, even during my predecessor's times. Once we have got over the current obstacle of who is in power in Botswana now, and we've got elections later this year, and we are all very focused to ensuring that we remove this cancer, which is currently in our country and destroying it. And I'm hopeful that, and all the indications are that we will be successful. And as for the, so for the country, I think people are really craving the good old days, you know, right from independence days and up until 2018, to get us back to where we were so that we can go around this world holding our heads up high, being proud of the democracy that we were known for and the reputation we had, which has now been totally destroyed.
And finally, Mr. President, what is life after presidency like? What's been keeping you busy lately?
Well, right now, here in South Africa, and I'm alive today sitting in front of you because I came to South Africa. Had I not, I wouldn't be here. So as I had indicated to you previously, I was just doing my charitable work, which scared the president, the current president, because he thought I would overshadow him, because people were inviting me here, there, and everywhere, and I was going out and helping people, and he didn't, that bothered him. That's the sort of small-minded situation we're dealing with. Whilst I'm here, since I've been here, I have been appointed a patron of the Pan-African Heritage Museum, which is in Ghana. In fact, I'll be, not too distant future, I'll be going there for a fundraising event. And it's a museum which has been physically built, which is going to harness a lot of the, and display a lot of the culture and traditions of and the monarchies which have been on this continent, and showing off traditions and culture, the cuisines and so on, not only for the African people on the continent, but also the diaspora. And it's sort of like going to be a one-stop shop for all the continent's traditions and culture. So that's a very exciting project that's been done. I'm also part of the Africa Forum, and in fact, I've been given the responsibility to convene the Southern African region. Africa Forum is an organization of former heads of state from the continent. So I'm involved with that. I'm a director on the Brentes Foundation, which, as you know, is an organization that a think tank which is engaged in coming up with solutions to conflict resolution on the continent and the promotion of democracy on our continent. Like I said earlier, I'm still a pilot, so I keep up my flying. I'm involved in conservation. I've become president of Green 14, which is present in 9 African countries, president of the advisory board. We're setting up a conservation organization here called the Guardian Angel Wildlife and Marine Trust, which is in the process of being set up. So I'm doing that conservation work. I'm very involved also with politics back home in Botswana, only because, even though I told you earlier, I really didn't want to be in politics. And when I left office, I was happy that it's behind it. But it's the only weapon I have now to salvage the situation our country is going through. So I'm very involved in that. And I gym 3 hours a day, you know, 1.5 in the morning, 1.5 later in the day, because I've always wanted to, you know, to keep fit. Wow.
Yeah, that puts me to shame. Mr. President, this has been fantastic. You sound like you've been very busy, so I'm extremely honored to have had this time with you. Yes. So thank you so much for sitting with me and sharing
your
insights and experience.
You're welcome. Thank you, so thank you very much. Right. Thank you.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrentisfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brentis Foundation podcast. And it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.